Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK Public Radio in Petersburg. It's Midday Magazine for Monday, the 13th of February, 2017. I'm Joe Vicnicki with the local news. 2 days after a fishing vessel went missing in the Bering Sea, U.S. Coast Guard officials say there has been no sign of the ship or the six people on board since searchers found its emergency beacon and some debris Saturday afternoon. Fishing vessel destination sent a distress signal Saturday morning 2 miles northwest of St. George Island. Coast Guard launched an air search for the 98-foot crabber, which is based in Sandpoint and Seattle. A man named David Wilson and his brother have owned the boat for more than 30 years.
They are a long-time Alaska fishing family with deep roots in the Sandpoint community.
That's Michael Barcott, a maritime attorney representing the destination's owners. He says the vessel was on its way to fish for a Pelio snow crab when the crew activated its electronic position indicating radio beacon, or EPIRB.
It had left Sandpoint, called in Dutch to pick up some bait, and it was on its way to St. Paul Island. The EPIRB went off at 6:11 in the morning, Saturday morning, and it appears that it was somewhere between 2 and 4 miles off St. George Island at the time.
Coast Guard has not released any theories as to what may have happened to the destination, and Barcott says the owners do not know either.
We know this. This was a really good and experienced crew. The captain and the crew were professionals. This captain had been on this boat for a long time. The boat was in good condition, and it is an absolute mystery what happened.
Coast Guard Petty Officer Lorraine Steenson says searchers found the boat's emergency beacon at sea Saturday afternoon among a debris field containing buoys, a life ring, and an oil sheen. Search has since continued with no luck. Steenson says the Coast Guard cutter Morgenthau is still searching, along with several helicopter and airplane crews. Meanwhile, St. George residents are patrolling the shoreline for signs of the vessel or its six missing crew members. And the Coast Guard is searching for two men whose 16-foot skiff capsized near the southern end of Gravina Island between Saturday night and Sunday morning near Ketchikan. Petty Officer Bill Colclaw says two helicopter crews from Air Station Sitka and two boat crews from Coast Guard Station Ketchikan are conducting that search.
So right now, Coast Guard crews are saturating a search area of about 200 miles that encompasses Nichols Passage and Tongass Narrows, as well as the entrance to George and Carroll Inlets, again with two helicopter crews and two boat crews to locate the two men.
Colclaw did not have the names of the two missing men or the towns they were from, but he said they were 45 and 38 years old. He said they left Mountain Point near Ketchikan either late Saturday or early Sunday. The fiancé of one of the men expected them to arrive on Annette Island shortly after their departure. When they didn't make it on time, she called the Coast Guard.
We're searching throughout tonight, and the Coast Guard cutter Maple is expected to arrive on scene tomorrow morning, and they will be conducting search efforts throughout the day.
Colclaw said the Coast Guard was able to make a quick response because they were called shortly after the men went missing. He said having information about the vessel, time and place of departure, and location they're trying to reach is critical in a search and rescue. Petersburg's fishing fleets made over $45 million in income from seafood catches 2 years ago and landed about 70 million pounds of seafood that year. That's one of the findings in an annual compilation of Alaska commercial fishing data released this winter by the industry group United Fishermen of Alaska. UFA publishes catch numbers for commercial fishing communities around the state using data from the state and federal government. Value and volume of Petersburg's catch fluctuates widely from year to year because of the ups and downs of salmon runs and prices. 2015 catch ranked Petersburg the 18th commercial fishing port in the nation by volume and 26th by value. Overall, the local catch was just under 70 million pounds, worth just over $39 million at the docks. Salmon made up 44 million pounds of that catch, worth about $16 million. Petersburg had 508 people who earned commercial fishing permits. Total permits owned was 1,126. Another 381 people had crew licenses. Total of 589 boats were homeported in Petersburg that year. The community also had 534 seafood processing jobs, 174 of those were worked by Alaska residents. Total processing wages in 2015 topped $5 million. Those fishing fact sheets for this and other Alaska towns can be found on the industry group's website, ufafish.org. A Kaufman Cove resident is trying to start up a marijuana cultivation business in the Prince of Wales Island community. But first, he needs the support from the town's voters. Angela Denning has more on that story.
Kaufman Cove has about 200 year-round residents. Voters there have not approved having a marijuana business in town. Not yet, anyway. But Kaufman Cove resident Brian Wilson Jr. hopes to change that.
A lot of people will vote based off of their personal opinions towards it. They don't go off facts. They don't go off the studies that have been done recently.
Wilson Jr. is trying to start up a cultivation business in Kaufman Cove, which would be housed on his private property. Ever since the state approved marijuana businesses, he's wanted to get involved in what he calls an up-and-coming trend.
I think it's an industry that could benefit Southeast Alaska, because all of our small towns have such limited resources for income and small economies, which is based around tourism mainly, and commercial fishing. So having a new industry for Alaska, I think, is wonderful.
Wilson Jr. has submitted application documents to the state, but the process is on hold until Kaufman Cove voters approve marijuana businesses locally. The issue has already failed on a close vote once, but Wilson Jr. says he'd like to get another public vote this summer. In the meantime, he'll try to educate the public on the way he views marijuana.
There's a whole industry and there's a whole other side of it other than marijuana is illegal and it's bad.
He plans to provide marijuana to any retail store in the Prince of Wales area that might open up in the future and then expand to other areas in Southeast. He says he'd likely start to provide product to the larger island community of Craig eventually. It's accessible by road from Kaufman Cove. Craig voters have already approved allowing a retail marijuana store in town, but no one has opened one there yet. In the best-case scenario, Wilson Jr. sees getting his business started in 6 months. As for the business name Dazed Dog Gardens, Wilson Jr. says it's named after his dog.
I have a dog who's 14 years old, and his name is Dazed. I work construction and travel throughout different towns, and he goes with me, and a lot of people know him better than they know me.
Wilson Jr. says his application materials are complete. He's just waiting on the okay from the Kaufman Cove residents. The Kaufman Cove city office was closed when this story was produced, but some city council members confirmed that the initial vote was close, within 5 votes. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
In other news, the proposed reorganization of the Alaska Marine Highway System does not include privatization. Robert Venables with the Southeast Conference sent that message loud and clear to the Sitka Chamber of Commerce last week. Instead, Venables suggested that managing the ferries under a state corporation would give the system a public service mandate with a business-minded approach. Robert Woolsey has more on that story from Sitka.
The Southeast Conference signed a deal with the governor last spring to take the lead in designing a new business structure and operating plan for the Marine Highway. In November, the group released the results of their Phase 1 study, which included creating a public corporation to manage the state-owned vessels and terminals. The idea hasn't been universally well received. Robert Venables oversees the steering committee tasked with the project. He defended its work in his presentation to the Sitka Chamber of Commerce.
We're not advocating to privatize the ferry system. Okay, we're not even advocating for public authority, which is responsible for all of its fundraising. So I want to be very, very clear on that, because there's been some misconceptions that if somehow you partner with the private sector, either on board or on shore side with your assets that you have, that somehow you're privatizing it and you're doing away with the state's participation.
Among the early opponents of the plan is Sitka Senator Bert Stedman, who believes the new corporate structure would give Rail Belt legislators just the excuse they need to cut Marine Highway funding even further. Venables told the Sitka Chamber that a corporate board with expertise in marine transportation would likely look for ways to grow revenues. He also thinks that consistent leadership outside of the political arena would benefit the system.
But we do see the advantages of becoming a more nimble management that has a little more arm's length to the political influence that occurs on a day-to-day, month-to-month, every year, as you have elections and the whole process there.
The Southeast Conference will hold a mid-session summit in Juneau the second week of March. Marine highway reform is at the top of the agenda.
Our goal is to make a clear case for whether this public corporation should come together, what that business and strategic operating plan would look like, and then what the path would be legislatively to make that happen.
Among them, Juneau Senator Dennis Egan and Representative Sam Keto and Justin Parrish. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
High school and middle school students in Huna, a small village on Chichagof Island in Southeast, spent several days in a special training to learn how to choose happiness every day. Huna City school officials believe the training will help the kids there improve their lives. Quentin Chandler visited Huna and sat down on what's called the Orange Frog training.
This story starts with Superintendent of Huna City Schools, P.J. Ford Slack. She came to Huna as an emergency replacement for the district's last superintendent, and when she got to work, she noticed something.
The adults were really not happy. That didn't mean they actively knew that, but they seemed to be down.
Huna's community does feel a lot of stress. The isolated town's commercial fishing and processing industries dried up years ago. The school district is under heavy financial strain, and drug and alcohol dependence are growing concerns. Slack believes a teacher's attitude has a powerful impact on the kids they teach. So she started researching something called the Happiness Advantage. It's an idea based in research that points to a link between a positive mindset and success.
It seems to make sense that that would make a difference if the kids and the adults all learned a little bit about this and realized happiness was a choice.
The district in Huna used about $20,000 in grant funding from the federal government to bring in a training based on the work of author and motivational speaker Sean Aker. It's called the Orange Frog Project. The adults went through it months ago, and Slack says it's already changed some of their lives. Now, it's the students' turn.
Woo! You're on frog! Hey, let them know! Let's go!
Devin Hughes is calling for high fives, teaching the kids and staff that they should do the uncomfortable, be outwardly positive, even if it means being the weird one. Hughes is the chief inspiration officer for the International Thought Leader Network.
My whole mission, my tenet, is to go around and inspire, motivate others to achieve happiness and joy and optimism. It's pretty cool.
Hughes uses a comic book to jumpstart the training. It's a story about a bunch of sad green frogs and a happy frog who is slowly turning orange. The more the orange frog does to make himself happy, the better he gets at catching flies and the more orange he turns. Eventually, the other frogs copy him. They get happier, they catch more flies, and they start turning orange too. The moral is that happiness is a choice. It doesn't just happen. Hughes says his company travels to corporations around the world and to schools, teaching people to be orange.
So right now, I think schools are probably the fastest growing segment within our business. Because if you can get a kid, whether it's a kid that's 6 or 16, and start to rewire their brain and doing these things more often and feeling pretty good, behavior issues go down, test scores go up.
But let's walk this back. Hughes is saying he is being paid to teach people to be happy. Doesn't anybody question that?
Oh, all the time. I mean, people are like, really? Really? But if you think about it, when I ask the question, did you have anyone in your life when you were a youngster teach you this, give you the secret sauce to happiness? Something prescriptive, something actionable that you need to do to work on this, your mojo, your mindset. And universally, no one raises their hand.
He says after the initial skepticism, people usually jump in because who doesn't want to be happy?
Yeah, be this kind of orange frog, you could be this kind of orange frog, you could be a
stick orange frog.
The high schoolers seem to be embracing the message. All around the room, kids are wearing orange wigs, frilly orange necklaces, they've got orange marker on their faces. Any kind of prop or clothing they can find, they're wearing it. Hughes tells the kids to keep it positive. He has them share the best things happening in their lives with other people.
First rule of Orange Frog, if something good happens,
You have to talk about it. Because if you do not talk about it to the brain...
To the brain, it's like it never happened. Hughes asks them to run the halls, delivering what he calls joy bombs to people all over the building. So the kids give people unexpected high fives, hugs, and tell them they're awesome. Hughes tells them to think about how to stop their problems from keeping them down. He tells them to think about changing behaviors that affect everyone, things like bullying or ignoring kids they usually don't hang out with. At the end, Hughes asks the kids to spend time thinking about how they can remember to keep doing this after he leaves. Some of the kids say Orange Frog definitely changed their school's atmosphere, but will it last? Senior Kelsey Tyne isn't sure.
I think only time will tell with that one. I can see that a lot more people are upbeat than normal, and if it stays, it stays.
Other kids think they can easily turn their school orange in the long term. Superintendent Slack hopes so, too.
I'm hoping that this will help them, as they go through their life, know that they can make some choices and that those choices are tough sometimes. Life is tough, but there are ways that we can turn the frown the other way around and make it a smile.
She doesn't see this as some kind of silver bullet, but she hopes learning the Orange Frog strategies will help them develop better coping skills to handle whatever life throws their way. Reporting in Hoonah, I'm Quentin Chandler.
And for KFSK News, I'm Joe Vicnicki.